Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Nathan Englander's new novel, The Ministry of Special Cases, is set in Buenos Aires in 1976 during the time of the Dirty War. The main character, Kadish Poznan, son of a prostitute, earns his living effacing the headstones of dead Jewish criminals. Peyto, his sweet-natured but rebellious teenage son, is taken from home one evening by a group of armed men in front of his father's eyes. The fate of the Jews, the fate of the disappeared, the fate of one family, of a hopelessly lost father and a hopelessly lost son, all meet in the dark corridors of this harrowing novel. Englander's great gifts, wrote Peter Terzian in a review of the novel in book form, are, quote, an absurdist sense of humor and a brisk, almost breezy narrative voice. He handles his unbearable subjects with the comic panache of a vaudeville artist before delivering the final devastating blow. Nathan Englander grew up in an Orthodox neighborhood in West Hempstead on Long Island. One of his teachers encouraged him to read secular literature, including the works of Orwell, Kafka, and Camus. From then on, he was hooked. It's a much longer story than that, and perhaps Tommy will get him to talk about that tonight. Englander attended the State University of New York at Binghamton, where he double majored in Judaic studies and literature with an emphasis on creative writing. After college, he did graduate work at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop. The first editor to accept one of Nathan Englander's short stories for publication described his style as, quote, Isaac Bashevis Singer on crack. Mr. Englander's voice, he wrote, is distinctively his own. Actually, this is a quote from Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times in a glowing review of his debut collection of stories for the relief of unbearable urges. Mr. Englander's voice is distinctly his own, daring, funny, exuberant, keenly attuned to both the absurdities of life and its undertow of sadness and disappointment. In conversation with Nathan tonight is writer, author, film producer Tom Teichholz, whose award-winning column Tommywood, www.tommywood.com, on subjects literary, cinematic, historical, autobiographical, I have long admired in the Jewish Journal. In fact, he has a great one this week on the original Nuremberg Law document, which is on view at the Skirball Cultural Center. Tom's work has appeared in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Interview, and The Forward. He recently served as American film and TV editor of the second edition of the Encyclopedia Judaica. They will be in conversation tonight. Nathan will be reading some passages from his books. They will be happy to take some of your questions, and we'll have a microphone circulating in the audience, so we ask that you wait until it comes to you so that we can all hear the questions. Please turn off your cell phones and pagers. And now please welcome Nathan Englander and Tom Teichholz.
Since Louise took care of most of my questions with that introduction, I thought maybe we'd start with you reading the opening of the Ministry of Special Cases. All right, then. Give you a flavor of the book, which I believe is available in bookstores currently throughout North America.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see for how many more days. We're going to move our microphones as we've been ordered to.
Yeah.
That didn't take long to forget.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to read a page. That's. This is the start, and it goes from here. Thanks for coming. Jews bury themselves the way they live, crowded together, encroaching on one another's space. The headstones were packed tight, the bodies underneath, elbow to elbow and head to toe. Kadish led Pato through uneven rows over uneven ground on the benevolent self side. He cupped his hand over the eye of the flashlight to smother the light. His fingers glowed orange red in between as he ran his fist along the face of a stone. They were searching for Chezi Tublade's grave, and finding it didn't take long. His plot rose up sharply, his marker tipped back. It looked to Kadish as if the old man had tried to claw his way free. It also looked like Tublade's daughter had only to wait another winter and she wouldn't have needed to hire Kadosh Poznan at all. Marble, Kadosh had discovered, is chiseled into not for its strength but for its softness. As with the rest of the marble in the graveyard of the Society of the Benevolent Self, Chezi's marker was pocked and cracked, the letters wearing away. Most of the others were cut from granite. If nature and pollution didn't get to those, the local hooligans would. In the past, Kadosh had scrubbed away swastikas and cemented back broken stones. He tested the strength of the one over Two Blades' grave. Like taking a swing at a loose tooth, Kadosh said. I don't know, even know why we bother. A little longer and no sign of this place will remain. But Kadosh and Pado both knew why they bothered. They understood very well why the families turned to them with such urgency now. It was 1976 in Argentina. They lived with uncertainty and looming chaos. In Buenos Aires, they'd long suffered kidnap and ransom. There was terror from all quarters and murder on the rise. It was no time to stand out, not for Gentile or Jew. And the Jews, almost to a person, felt that being Jewish was already plenty different enough. Kadosh's clients were the ones who had what to lose, the respectable, successful segment of their community that didn't have in its families such a reputable past. In quieter times, it had been enough to ignore and deny. When the last of the generation of the benevolent self had gone silent, when all the plots on their side were full, the descendants waited what they thought was a decent amount of time for an indecent bunch and sealed up that graveyard for good.
I was blown away by the very first sentence, which I assure you I read further than that. But Jews bury themselves the way they live. Now, just the way that opens sort of right away gives us the sense of someone who's standing apart from the Jewish community. I mean, a little bit like the wicked son saying you.
Yeah. I guess for me, I had a separate relationship to it. I think I was traumatized, would be the word, by the last book. It was very hard to go back and write. You know, everything's a learning process. And the second book I had to write as a writer, the first book I had to write just as me, planning to starve to death, which I'm still planning to do, but that's a whole separate. We'll get to that later. But I just think for me, it was this idea where I thought the way one wants to have a departure, you don't want to write the same book again and again. And for me, this whole idea from the outside of, you know, you're supposed to be a Jewish writer, for me, it was just, it turned into a very limiting thing intellectually. The idea is, I guess people see it as almost, you know, rebellious on my part that I won't identify as a Jewish writer. Let's start with the nitty-gritty. I haven't mentioned the Holocaust yet. It's a record. But
we'll get there later.
Yeah, but
we'll get there later.
But the idea is, for me, it's like the idea would be a way of seeing my own characters as other. It's so the idea that I should say Kadosh is not a man. He's not a regular man. He's a man that's a Jew. That, to me, is somehow – I always think of James Baldwin if he'd sit down and be like, am I a black writer today or am I gay? You know, like he can't do his work that way. And for me, it was like a very freeing moment about 400 years into this process. This novel took forever. But when I just – yeah, to start with the word Jews, to start like that, for me, was the moment where I sort of own this world in a way and just felt like, you know, if you're not getting past the first Jews in my book, this ain't the book for you.
But not to sort of play, you know, CSI Buenos Aires here. But,
yeah.
But the again, crowded together, encroaching on one another's space. I mean, this is – all your stories are about people, and particularly Jews – bumping up against each other.
Yeah, I guess it's about that. I mean, this one, and about that difference again, but the first book for me was really, you know, I'm 37 now. It's too old to worry about. If you're still talking about being captain of the high school basketball team, it's time to change it up. But the first book was really about religious and secular and that balance. And for me, this one is so much more about community. And I guess it's about that suffocation and about otherness. You know, Kadosh, the main character, is his whole life is on the outside. And that's, yeah, I was really looking at community. And from so many levels, whether it's, you know, individual government is community, you know, humankind, all the different levels work through from, yeah.
Well, I thought now we would step back and talk about the community you grew up with a little bit.
Sure.
You told the bold type that you had a right-wing, anti-intellectual, fire and brimstone, free thought free, shtetl mentality, substandard education. But yeah. Tell us how you feel.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, it's, yeah, the internet's amazing, but these things last, I guess. I stand by that. I actually was very, that was the first time I still joke with my agent about this, but the first time I was misquoted, I was so upset, and she said, "Did you believe everything you read?" I said, "I did until, you know, right now." But I didn't understand. But it got twisted once, and that really upset me to comment. Human beings are supposed to be human, and it got twisted to as a commentary on my community, which I always leave alone. But the one thing I do beat on is my education, because that's a social contract, and I feel like they, you know, we were supposed to be educated in a certain way. So, yeah, I was, you know, I went to school, but I was not educated. They're two separate things.
But on the other hand, it seems like the perfect background for a writer, because it made you hungry.
Oh, God, yeah. If I wasn't a writer, I'd be really angry, but everything for me is...
Right, because you can imagine, I mean, whether it's Bellow or Roth or Singer saying the same thing about their educations, and that literature sort of was the ticket out of the ghetto.
Yeah, that's how it becomes holy, I think. If books save you, then you just become, you know, dedicated to them. So, and that's what I took away from that religious life. Like, I believe in the word. I love books.
And was there a particular work of literature that first sort of opened the door for you?
I think they got mentioned in the introduction, but yeah, all the hard consonants. But I again, about feeling trapped. But it was 1984, which I found the copy of in probably seventh grade or something like that.
Right.
And then, but then
Catcher in the Rye.
No, yeah.
Brave New World.
Too good a school. Brave New World. Uh-huh. Yeah. But more the plague really was gigantic for me, and all the Kafka and cheery books. That's all where.
When you go to law school, they teach you to think like a lawyer. Was there a skill or talent that you learned at yeshiva, that at your school, that kind of helped you when you started to write stories?
You know what it is? That's the thing that was amazing. There are people all the way over here. I like that the deep sincerity to storytelling. I got a real, you know, it says shtetl mentality, which can be an insult or a compliment. You know, it's bad when it's Netanyahu and you have nuclear weapons and a shtetl mentality, or it's different if you're teaching third grade. But the idea is that they didn't separate from us Midrash and Agadah, these like extra textual crazy stories about story. I still open the Bible all the time. Not all the time. Let's not get, but when I go to
occasion.
It on occasion, but I go looking for things that just aren't in there that I was taught as truth. The one I use as an example is when, you know, Pharaoh's wife was reaching for Moses and he was in the basket. You know, this idea that there were allegations that her arms became just miles and miles long, you know, just reached out. And I was taught this as truth as a little boy, like as in the Bible, you know, millions of stories like this that are just so amazing and wonderful by these, you know, long bearded men who were deeply sincere and also thought them that was word of God too. And I like that respect, that love of story as truth. I don't separate. I believe fiction is a truth greater than truth. I just think that, you know, so there's it.
I brought it up also because when I read your stories and even this novel, one word that comes to mind is disputatious. People really like to argue in it, and even there's a story you wrote called Peep Show. I don't know if, but where someone walks into a peep show off Times Square, and when the curtains go up the second time, it's a bunch of rabbis that he's arguing with suddenly.
Yeah.
I'm in conflict with story, but is that something that you took from your upbringing, education?
Yeah, I guess that's maybe how my head works.
I just want to bring out the distinction that you were raised modern Orthodox, not
Hasidic. No, modern Orthodox. So
Yiddish wasn't spoken.
No, I call it Gap Orthodox, like khakis, yarmulke, you know,
right.
That sort of.
Watching the World Series or not?
Yeah, exactly that. So I was going to say there was one Simchat Torah. I remember this. There were some timers set in town. Everybody went over to a Lou's house, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Okay. And then I've also read that when you went to SUNY Binghamton, you spent a junior year in Israel, and that's when you became a secular Jew, you've said.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the initial question about point of view. I mean, this about my head being a certain way, which is to me, you know, which I think I was fighting at the start of this book, which is there was only one way to be Jewish, which is our way, and everyone else is other. You know, like, that's the whole rest of the world. So it's not like it's a limited world to be an Orthodox Jew. It's a complete universe, and it's just the same here. I see you, first row. Everything else is fuzzy back there, and the other Jews are, you know, they might as well not be Jewish to us. And that makes a complete universe, you know, and I guess that's what I'm also looking at in this book, is that idea of, you know, where we draw the community boundaries. But I'd never seen a functioning secular Jew, because to me it's about knowledge. It's about, you know, can you speak Hebrew? Do you have these reference points? I like education a lot, and it was that idea where I'd never seen this strong a Jew with real, you know, to go to Binghamton and meet somebody who knew they were Jewish from Syosset or whatever didn't allow me to make the leap. But the first day I got to Israel and saw functioning Israelis.
And we talked about the experience of being in Israel and being on a bus and seeing Ethiopian Jews and South African Jews and every kind of Jewish face that you never thought might be Jewish.
Yeah, yeah.
You grew up.
It undoes your idea of, like, cultural dominance in the Jewish world, pretty quickly.
But then for a real change, you went to Iowa.
You know what that was like going to the, honestly, that's true. That was, I've been all over, you know, the world. Your culture shock is when you return, first of all. That's the idea. You know you're in a foreign place when you go abroad. But that same way, like, everything else made sense to me. But Iowa was definitely the hardest transition of my life. But I loved it. I loved it. But, it takes like 4 minutes to buy a pack of gum. I had to get used to that New York, you know, thing.
And there among the cornfields you started to write about Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, that's what those programs are good for. I feel like all my friends who are writing seriously, who are in workshop, it's sort of, all the guys who, you know, never got put in the basketball game on the bench. But sort of that idea where once you recognize even there that you're a freak, that's where you know you're maybe doing some good work.
And then from being the one guy writing, everybody's writing.
Everybody's writing and trying to kill each other. We all act there. Honestly, it's a terrifying week with reviews and all this businessy stuff that's none of my business. But we used to, nothing will ever be harder than workshop. We acted as if there's like the bookstore holds one, there was room on the shelf for one singular volume. And we wrote as if to kill each other.
Well, you've said that you thought stories are really should be about life and death, and I guess you got that feeling there.
Yeah. Well, I like a big story. Yeah, I think it should.
When you started to first write your first stories, did you feel you were being transgressive? Were you afraid people would be?
I'm an absolute coward, and on every front. There's two things I decide, like, and though I still might pass out here in front of you, but I have to talk into the microphone. There's two things I'm not going to be afraid of. Like, you can be nervous, when I get off the stage, I'll be nervous again, and just you have to own that world. Like, everything else is terrifying to me, except, and the process itself is terrifying. But you have to just own that material. Even this is Buenos Aires, 1976. It's new for them. It is living. They just arrested, and we'll get to that too, but Isabelita a few months ago. It's not over for them. And it's like writing about their Holocaust, and I'm not from there, and I have no connect. It's just dizzying for me to even think of the material I dare touch here, but it's just too bad. Some people ask me, how can you write about the Holocaust? If at some point you have to decide if it comes out of my head, I guess I must own, this is all out of my head.
But when you were writing it, did you think that these are just the stories I have within me, or were you thinking that they were the stories that were, do you think of them as Jewish stories? Or did you just think these are the stories, the situations that I know?
Oh, God, no. Do I have a laser pointer? This is where I pull the whiteboard down and start drawing for everyone. But it's like, I always do the proprioceptive relationship, like you just move your finger, I know where my hand is and I move it. Like, that was one of the things is finding, again, it's the one thing that's clear to me in this world is about craft. Like, here I am, here the book is, and deciding. Because otherwise, it's nice. Like, if I'm tired, too bad, I work. If I want to go out, too bad. It's none of my business what I think, what I'm trying to write about. I was talking about this before it came out here.
It chooses you. You don't choose it?
I think it's a romantic notion that writers have, which I love. I feel like my friends talk that way. We talk about the final draft as if I could have gotten up like one morning 8 years ago and just written this draft. But you have to believe in process. So the idea is it is a construct. It is a force. It's not about inspiration. There is the element of idea.
90% perspiration?
Yeah, but this continuum where I, Kaddish, the main character, I can have draft. I'm sure there's a draft I have him where he's 7 feet tall and another one where he has an eye patch and a parrot on his shoulder. You draw all that. And then they take form, and this is where I get all touchy-feely, but it's an organic process. At some point, everything better make its own demands. The book will make its own demand. I talk about knowing when it was started, but knowing when it was done is the main character, Lily, and a friend's favorite line that I pulled from the book. And, again, I always say this book's not called Look How Smart Nathan Is. That's how you edit. Like, that has to come out, your theories, your research. But this one line that I was so desperate to have in this book that was so close to my heart that just I knew was just central to Lillian. I can even tell you.
Yeah, please. Last,
but it was about, I just wanted her, like, built into every day was a moment of forgetting for Lillian, that there was a second that she'd forget her son, who you can't get past the flap copy. He disappears in the first section of the book. But this idea where I thought, you know, I just wanted this nice moment of her washing dishes. I just wanted this moment of forgetting. It was a lot of it's big concepts that boil down. You know, I'll write a 100-page conversation, then it's a line, and I, you know, pressurize that way. But that idea when I couldn't find a place, there was no space in this book when she became so herself and her search for her son became so extreme that I said there will not be a second in the day. There was no place in this book to force in a line that I, as author, wanted in there. I said that's when she is her. You know,
And there's separated.
There's a point where they have their own needs and their own, and you can't get them to say what is not
true. You hear them talking.
I don't like to admit the kooky parts.
Okay.
Yeah.
For the Relief of Unbearable Urges came out, Mel Gusso of the New York Times called them a collection of 9 stories about Orthodox Jews in extreme circumstances, which again sounds more like a reality show.
Yeah.
Orthodox Jews Extreme Edition. But there was a lot of success, a lot of awards, the Penn Malamud, Sue Kaufman Prize. Yeah. Was it hard to get back to the work following that? I mean...
I didn't do a Hebrew translation till a couple of years ago, so...
Because you were living in Jerusalem?
Yeah, and that was nice to go... It's hard to know anyone who knows Jerusalem. It's just impossible to live there. That's what makes it great. But the last thing I needed was the guy at, like, my grocer, you know. I just didn't want to be...
But Jerusalem's the place you went to not have to deal with the Jews, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sort of upside down that way. But it was a nice place to go back to after and
get
back to
work. You know the Oscar Wilde? No, about Oscar Wilde eating at the Eiffel Tower.
No.
He used to eat at the Oscar Wilde had lunch every day at the Eiffel Tower, and then someone says, you know, excuse me, Mr. Wilde, why do you have lunch here every day? He says, well, it's the only place in Paris where I don't have to look at that goddamn tower.
Exactly. Sort of like that.
Yeah. And when you came back to Jerusalem, this was your second time in Jerusalem, right?
Because I did my junior year there, and I got bit. I just fell in love. I mean, I probably should have gone to Rome, and it would have had an easier time of it. It's almost the same bad parliamentary system and overprotected mothers. It's almost the same country. I was going back summers, and after Iowa, I was within 2 weeks, I was living there for the next 5 years, so.
But there's a line in your story, In This Way We Are Wise, I thought I'd learned everything about Jerusalem only to discover my information was old. Did you feel Jerusalem had changed, or?
Oh, I guess that's, you know, you go back to story, but I got to lay down on the couch for this. But it's just a very complicated thing to be raised with this very, again, back to story, this great biblical love of Jerusalem. Uh-huh. One of my earliest memories are about this place, and then to find it as a real place is very... A Christian friend told me my mother went on those tours and was just really upset to see somebody water skiing on the Sea of Galilee. You know, like... You just don't want to see anyone standing on that.
The amazing thing for me is when you go to Jerusalem and all those places that you think of as things that go on dashboards or whatever are actually places.
Oh, it's just weird to be on the treadmill looking at the old city wall, you know, at the hill.
Really be walking the Stations of the Cross and to...
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And yet there are good cafes.
Yes, there are the best.
Yeah. Of course, I have to ask you the question your fans most care about, which is when did you cut your hair? I just want to explain is that Nathan had the good author photo problem, and so
there was a lot of talk about the hair. So my friends had an intervention basically when I moved back to New York, an alcoholic. Yeah. They really, they didn't want to be, it was really intense. I'd say, that guy has long hair, and they'd say, what's he doing? I'm like, speaking Hebrew and on a moving truck. I could not find anyone not Israeli with that haircut. They made me cut it off, and now people call me sir, not miss. It's a whole new reality.
Let's talk a little bit about the process of writing the ministry. Was there a genesis moment? When did you first start thinking about it?
It's I feel almost this is where I do the long pause, but it's very strange to talk about it now because these things are infinite. I feel like there's just millions of threads from it's such a complicated thing how
it
ends up.
Did you want to do it when you were in Iowa? Did it?
I knew for a long time. I mean, but the idea is that it ends up being, you know, called Argentina. Like it's sort of, it wasn't a Michener thing where I sent out my, we're doing Hawaii. Today is the tell. You know, it wasn't a choice of subject. It's more. Again, it doesn't work when I'm talking as fast as I can into a microphone, but I feel like a shy person. And the idea is that I feel very safe, much safer in a very distant setting. So the idea that the things that were really close to me, Argentina, seemed like the setting.
Well, you wanted to make something your own. And
yeah, it's my Buenos Aires, but it was more like these ideas of living in Jerusalem, just this idea, even the idea of wanting the life of the individual. What does that mean? You know, in New York, everything's about my life. You know, we all have these very, you know.
But you were set on doing a novel after.
Oh God, yeah, in that way, absolutely. I knew I wanted to do a novel.
It wasn't like someone was saying, you know.
No, not that. I call that the workshop two-step, where everybody thinks you have to do your stories.
And your agent says, no, now grow up, do another.
Yeah. None of that. I just wanted to try the form, and it, but this was the story. It was just growing for years.
You first went to Argentina.
I went in 1991 for friends. I'd met these, and that's another part of the genesis of the story, but I had these Argentine friends in Jerusalem in 89 who were just, I mean, they trust me only now after nearly 20 years of friendship, I'd say. But they're just damaged in such a specific way, the way they trust and talk, and it's just amazing for me.
You said these people are for me.
But shaped by politics in such an extreme way that I say, like, growing up under Jimmy Carter has not made me the man I am today. But they are, you know, I was going to say.
Or maybe it has.
Yeah, I was going to say the Bush kids will have a different. But you know, these guys are so shit. And it just interested me where they came from, what did that to them. And then I ended up there for a wedding and a honeymoon and spent 6 weeks there. But that was perfect. I didn't even know I was going to be a writer then. And that allowed for this world. I really loved that idea where I had this vague memory of place that let me build my city on top of it. You know, I just felt the avenues or a coffee shop.
And did you have any sense of where the story was going? Or?
Yeah, no, I always knew. It's just certain things you write towards. I mean, I learned that with the collection, and it's another reason to start with short fiction. I love the form. I think it's a pure, I just love the spring-loaded way a story is built. I love to read them and I love to write them. But it's also an education. If you write at my speed, this would be a 100-year book, you know, the 9 stories. So for me, it's the idea where you start to learn how to listen to yourself. You know, one story will be a snippet of dinner conversation. Another one will be towards an idea. Another one will be the dark joke of it. So I sort of knew as all these ideas sort of coalesced or started to grow into something, there was always this one moment. When things are going well, but the novel was sold on one page of it, which I wrote, and it was very late. It's probably in the last 20 pages of the book or 30 pages of the book. And I just always dreamed, I believe in executing the unexecutable. That's how I see fiction, because nothing scares me off more than a writer who writes a book he or she knows he can write. That's, you know, I know it's going to take me 10 years. There's an action, the husband. It all comes down to, well, it all builds towards an end. It was Paul Auster quoting Mickey Spillane, somebody like that, said nobody reads a book to get to the middle. There's this.
You knew what you were working towards.
Yeah, this one moment that I said, there's no way in this universe that anyone could make this decision, say these things, do this act. I said, it is not possible to construct a world where this will happen. And then I said, I want to go do this.
Do that.
And I, you know, probably was 8 years in when I was sitting at the New York Public Library, I think, when I got to it, and just got to this moment where this was the only decision that could be made, and I had to go hunt this page, you know, that I'd written. And of course, you know, I just didn't even know where it was. And of course, my house, you know, bills unpaid, phone shut off, that kind of guy. But then I found, you know, those files are in order, and I found it, and basically a couple of tweaks, you know, tense stuff, but laid in this page, you know, almost a decade later.
Wow.
So, but yeah, I was always writing towards this moment, you know.
Well, let's now have you read from the novel.
All right, then. Yeah, I'm going to read you a short chapter, unless it feels unbelievably long to you. But about 12, 13 minutes and a half. This is chapter 6. The book, the novel is set, we said, the Dirty War. I was going to say March 24th, but part of what interests me, 1976, but part of what interests me in this book, I got all interested or in the way an ignorant novelist does, but in physics without knowing physics. But the whole quantum, we can talk about that too, but it's sort of quantum mechanical in structure to me. But how things start before, so even this chapter where we say the coup was the 24th, it started the 23rd, except it started with Isabelita, except these things that happen in society start before. But the main players are Kadish Poznan, who is the father, Lillian, the mother, who works in insurance, and she's on her way to the office, and their son, Pato, who is disappeared. And this is the coup day. And again, I'll read you that chapter. As four men from the Navy threw a career army man from the window, he was thinking his last thoughts. A retired colonel, his uniform covered in the ribbons and medals of a military regime. All those decorations were upended along with him as the blood rushed to his head. A medal came loose and clanked against the street. A chest full of honors, and what good did it do him? I should have served in the Air Force, he thought. Then I would have wings. With that, not even the time for a cynical upturn of the lips, he hit the avenue of the Liberator, and along with the countless motions that make up a late night in Buenos Aires, that together are the heartbeat of any city in the world, Lillian Poznan turned her head on the pillow to have her last deep sleep before her fears turned real. Lillian didn't feel the city was light one resident when she woke up. She didn't feel, as she often did in the kitchen with her bills, that the country was united and spinning out of control. Looking into the street, she didn't sense that there were right then a million more working stiffs in front of a million more windows, all in it together, all but the colonel, his window still open, a cat curled up on its ledge. Lillian had slept well. She'd woken up rested to find that Kadish still hadn't come home, and miracle of miracles, Pato had already left for school. She took her time getting ready. El Golpe, the Sting, played on the radio, and she tried to remember what theater she saw the movie in. She stood in her stockings eating a pastry over the sink as she decided on the beta on Laval. Lillian waited for the old cage elevator that ran up the center of their building like a spine, the staircase snaking around it. She waited with a hand on the gate, one knee locked and one knee bent to compensate for the weight of her briefcase. The door to Katja's apartment opened. Her neighbor was still in his pajamas and had a worried look on his face. He scratched furiously at one of his eyebrows, and because of this, Lillian noticed that the other one was chapped and red. He was an early riser, a militant in his lifestyle. She'd never before seen Cacho in his bedclothes, never with a wrinkle in his shirt, even at the end of the day. She'd always felt he must keep an iron at the office, hidden in his desk. "Are you home from work today, Cacho?" "Work today," he said, and went back to scratching. "Work today," he repeated, standing up on his tiptoes to look behind Lillian and keeping an eye on the stairs. That's when the question turned entertaining, the best thing he'd heard in a while. Cacho gave a quick laugh. "Work today, would you?" "Obviously," Lillian said, and held up her briefcase heavy with files. "It's rhetorical," Cacho said, almost screaming. "The question is, would you go to work if you were me? Would you go out this morning if you were me?" Lillian had never seen Cacho like this, and waiting for an answer to his rhetorical question, he switched to the other eyebrow, and she saw that on the first there was blood. He had scratched himself bloody. "If you were in my position, would you even leave the house today?" "I don't know," Lillian said. "What is your position?" "What does it matter? You're already in it, and still you go." With this, he dropped his hand from his eyebrow, only to throw both arms up in frustration. He retreated into the apartment and slammed the door. Lillian was so intrigued by this, she didn't notice for another couple of minutes that the elevator was out again. She had slept well. She was happy and took the stairs. It wasn't long before Lillian understood the position she and Cacho were in, the one Kadish and Pato were in, the position they were all in, especially, but not really any more especially, that their leader, Isabelita, was in or already out of that morning. Lillian was walking down Avenida de Macho toward the pink house and the plaza in front of it, the route she took every day. Except there was a roadblock up ahead, and beyond that a tank in the middle of the city. It was preposterous, and Lillian looked to her right and her left to see if there was anyone to share this with. She saw a man going the other way who would not make eye contact, and then in an empty parking lot, a little way down, she spotted a Dodge pickup. In it were eight soldiers in uniform, in helmets even, crouched down, covering the directions of the compass. Three were facing her from the back end where Dodge was stamped in large letters and a pickaxe mounted across the name. The muzzles of the boys' machine guns stuck out over the truck's rear. Lillian looked behind her for the war, for the onslaught, and then again at these young boys, the kind that came knocking on the door for Pato and then slunk off with him, record albums in stacks under their arms. These boys were neater, short-haired, and they were crouched down, guns at the ready. A flatbed truck with a tank on its back crawled across the next avenue. Another one followed behind. These trucks, moving through the city at a speed fit only for funeral processions, lumbering along. Where is the surprise at this speed? Trouble does not break out anywhere in the world, Lillian thought. War is not unleashed. It is slowly, it is carefully installed. Lillian looked toward her neat little soldiers in their parking space. It's almost as if there should have been something to say. If they were not pointing guns, that is, if they were not in the military, she'd have said, there are tanks up ahead. But they probably knew that, could see them just as well as she did. Lillian turned around and went back to the last corner and took a different way to work. It seemed they were having a coup. It seemed they were having a coup, and for this, Cacho stayed home to scratch out his eyes. Frieder was at her desk when Lillian walked in. She said before anything, Isabelita is trapped in the pink house. It'll be over before it starts. A day at the most, Gustavo was saying. We're going back to a military government. You'd think they'd have come home, Lillian said. Kaddish was gone and Pato off to university before I got up. Classes must be canceled. Where would the kids go? Lillian shook her head. When do I ever sleep late? Adaptability, Gustavo said. He was out of his office and inserting himself into the conversation as if Lillian had been talking to him. It was Gustavo's way of being boss, of owning everything there. He stood between them and smoothed down his hair. We have inbred ourselves into supreme adaptability, and now it's become a detriment. We'll get used to this government, same as the last, and if it turns on us, we won't even see it coming. We'll go down thinking all is well. Gustavo said this as if the three of them were observing it from Switzerland. He spoke with a certain glee. Lillian nodded a thank you and turned her back to him and said very clearly to Frieda alone, a truck full of men point their guns at me, and still I go on my way. Gustavo circled around and returned himself to the conversation. After the soldiers, who else should come to work more than you? We sell insurance. Today is what we're about. It's our big gamble. We pay out, others pay in. And, Frieda said, dragging out the word, life, property, all the values shift. You'll see when things settle. Much will have become precious, and many will have no worth at all. Frieda gave up. She asked for the advice that he dispensed regardless. So then what do? Sit here and wait? We get down to business, Gustavo said. Life and death you can't control now. It is only profit that can be arranged absolutely during a war. Who are we having a war with? Frieda said. That's the point. Figure out the sides and begin to earn. With that, Gustavo went back into his office. Lillian took Frida's hands. You'd think Pato, he's very sensitive. You'd think he'd have turned back from school. A glass floated above the floor, held steady by five fingers pressed from above around the rim. The fingers were of a hand, the hand of an arm, and the arm hung disembodied behind the back of the couch. Lillian dropped her keys on the little antique shelf. She dropped her purse loudly by the wall underneath. The glass held steady. The arm did not move. The television, visible beyond the couch, showed the Liberator's Cup, River Plate versus Portuguesa. The little men ran back and forth. Lillian couldn't see the ball through the smoke, a thin gray cloud in front of the black and white of the set. Lillian approached, leaning over and kissing Kaddish on the head. He put his cigarette in the ashtray resting on his stomach and placed the glass on his chest. I'll know you're dead, she said, if I ever come home and find that cloud missing or that glass knocked over on the floor. What's wrong with ritual, Kaddish said. It doesn't hurt for some things to stay the same. No, Lillian said. She agreed. Kaddish sat up with his back against the arm of the couch, his legs stretched out. He moved the ashtray to the floor. Crazy day, he said. Very crazy. Lillian smiled and went to sit. Kaddish raised his legs and Lillian slipped in underneath and patted them down. She closed her eyes and let herself relax. She listened for the music that was always on and always too loud, emanating from Pato's room. Lillian couldn't hear it, and that only meant headphones or a grinding needle when the boy passed out. Creatures of habit, her husband and her son, they shared a great love for the comfort of sameness. He asleep, Lillian said. Out, Kaddish said. With a tilt of her head, screwing up her face, she stared hard at her husband, trying to understand. She stared hard at her husband and was already mad at herself. On coup day, on this day, how would she not race straight for his room to check? Then there was Kaddish, this man who understood nothing, whom she could not, for a few hours, trust. Out, Lillian said, with the hairy one, that kid that looks like an octopus, all head. Rafa, Lillian said, then as an afterthought, distracted with worry, it is time you learned your son's friends' names. He came by, Rafa did, and they went off to some bar. Lillian pushed Kaddish's legs off her lap so that he sat up straight so that she could stand up and face him. What bar do you think is open tonight? How could you let him leave? She looked toward the door as if Pato might come through it. And then she asked, quite calmly, don't you have any sense of your own? I told him. He doesn't listen. Then tie him up, hold him down. If your son doesn't listen, why didn't I find you by the door sitting on his back? Uncontrollable, Kaddish said, by his father uncontrollable. Rebellious Jewish boys only listen to their mothers. For fathers, they have no use. Thanks.
The protagonist's name is Kaddish. Tell us what that means and what it means to you in this context. I mean,
yeah, that's, I was going to say, just saying that is its own question. But yeah, people ask me, you know, what about a man named Kaddish who works in a cemetery? Kaddish is the Jewish prayer of mourning, Tefillat Ashkava, the prayer for the dead. But yeah, people ask me about it as if I wasn't, I was aware of that. Yeah. he works in a cemetery. But in terms of building world, back to like, you know, I'll turn this into a workshop yet, then a conversation. But back to owning worlds, like if I thought about that long and hard, I'm like, if I can't pull that part off, we got other problems in this novel. Like that's, to me, just who he is, and that was his name. It's a Jewish tradition that I love. This book is so much about identity, whether it's national identity and, you know, personal identity, what it is to be a Jew. I mean, and we can get into personal stuff after, but all these different things, like what does a name mean? And there's this wonderful Jewish tradition, say a man has a serious heart attack and survives it, he might take on a new middle name or change his first, alter his name in some way, which is, to me, touched me so deeply, this idea that the angel of death, to like put so much weight on the name that like more than your soul, that if that changes, it might not even come for your spirit. Yeah. But what that means, that the angel of death would have you not on his list anymore just from your name, that that's so who you are. And that touched me deeply. And with sickly children, they've done it. In the book, Kaddish is a very sickly child, and he's given this name, Kaddish, so that he should be the mourner instead of the mourned. And that's sort of his blessing and his curse, what it is to be designated to spend your life as the mourner.
In this novel, there are two things, well, there are many things going on, but two in particular, which have to do with the Jewish criminal past in Buenos Aires, which is part of this benevolent self, shul. And at the same time, there's the disappeared in the dirty war. And although we know from Timmerman's book, Timmerman's
prisoner
great book,
yeah, it's a wonderful book.
Prisoner without a
name, cell without a
cell
number.
Without a number, that being Jewish was reason enough to be disappeared, the two are not completely linked. And I wondered how you approach this as linked or as a dissonance or?
Yeah, two very separate subjects. There's the dirty war disappeared, and then I was at in Buenos Aires a couple of months ago, and was invited to an Argentine home for a Jewish home for Friday night dinner, and they said, you know, the whole family circle, you know, what's your novel about? I was like, the two most painfully uncomfortable subjects that I might muster right now. But at the turn of the century in Argentina in the 1900s, you know, early 20th century, but when Jews who were doing the shmata trade, the rag men, tailors, all those jobs we think of, push carts in the Lower East Side, in Argentina, they also had their share of they were white slavers. They were Jewish pimps and prostitutes.
Kidnapped women from Eastern Europe and brought them to Argentina.
Kidnapped, or women who went by choice when the other choice was starving to death or, you know, working to death, or they were tricked, or they got there and instead of getting to the agricultural center, they'd be talked into it, or they thought they were married, or, you know.
But eventually they had their own shuls.
They had their own. Well, this was the idea that this is, again, this book would have been easy. I talk about negative space, but this idea, we were talking backstage about that, but this idea of like ownership of place. You know, I always, the example I like to use is those who know you, New York, if I'd want to say, meet me at the New York Public Library, I said, I'll see you at the Lion. You wouldn't say like, I walked up three stairs, there's a balustrade, there's eight tables. You know, these are the things that drop out when you own a city where I feel like I pulled my research out and, you know, million parts of this book that I felt to own it is to make it of their world. But I did not want to go towards the sensational, which is I could write, you know, torture day in and day out. And I wanted it to be about this one family and for the story to, you know, for that to get built in a quiet way. And the Jewish Whorehouse, I probably have, you know, eight more novels in my closet of fun stuff at the Jewish Whorehouse. But it's not their lives that I was interested in. It's more their death, which is, again, what it is to stand in judgment of somebody else, which is these women wanted to be buried. You know, we can leave the pimps out because that's a more corrupted position. But these women wanted to be buried as Jews, and the community, Argentina is maybe the only country in South America with a real functioning middle class, but that's disappearing, but so is mine in New York at a rapid rate. But if anyone has an apartment they want me to sit, but anyway, but just this idea the community was moving up and they were so ashamed of these people and wanted nothing to do with them, but that idea they forced them to form, there is, again, I got to see it finally, it was called the Tzvi Migdal Society, and there's a little space in La Tablada, but they have their own Pimps and Whores cemetery, but to go see this pristine cemetery with a guy in there alone, you know, I think I was the first one to knock on the door and I don't know how long he came out, you know. But this pristine cemetery, and then over the wall, overgrown, headstones tipped over, like this idea for someone to stand in judgment, like how pure are you that you can judge someone for an eternity, a punishment that lasts forever. And that just really touched me, this idea of how we interact with people, which leads into this idea of how a society functions when people are disappearing from it. And, you know, we can get into habeas corpus, which is a central metaphor to the book, which is no longer a metaphor. I ended up with an accidental political position, which is another separate matter.
All the characters have a very complicated relationship to their identity, particularly the Jewish characters. I mean, you have Kaddish and Lillian and the Dr. Mazursky and even the head of the Jewish community, Feigenblum. It's a wider spectrum of sort of Jewish experience that you'd ever written about before.
And, yeah.
And I thought how that challenge, you know.
Well, I guess this is where it gets personal, but I think it was that, again, that time living, you know, I'd spent my whole life in America as a Jew, and then I got to Israel and I was no longer Jewish, but then I was an American. And for this book, I was living life as a writer. And you start becoming, which is a position, it's an outside position, being right. A writer. You know, it's other, you know, so often at party, people love to say, like, you're writing this down. I was like, it's not that good a party. But, but this idea of, I guess, just going through Jerusalem and wanting, like, is it self, just this idea of what is to want the life of the individual and the responsibility towards community, community's responsibility towards you. And that moves out for me to, again, the Jewish community and then to the state. You know, I used to think about it all the time because it doesn't have to be about politics. It's not who started, and though that's all, you know, the newspapers cover is who's responsible, you know. It's just, when you're living in town, it's just simply whether it's Hamas first or Israel first. Like, they, you know, when... whether Israel calls it a strike back, I'd say you're going to blow up this and then they're going to blow us up in my neighborhood, you know, in response. It doesn't matter who's right. Like, the government making these decisions where I'm like, people are going to die at my market soon. You know, when you start to think of these levels of responsibility and how they trickle down and my responsibility to them. And this was just, again, an extreme, a distant setting and a pressurized setting to look at, especially a polite
characters
society.
Would create a pecking order automatically themselves.
Yes, yeah, that's the terrarium that is this, you know, why you build a universe, is for me to look at these things, back to me being indecisive. I don't have answers, but what a novel allows is for me to explore my questions in the extreme, down to the split where it's almost, again, and that falls away, a novel back to making its own demands. It doesn't stay in even mathematical form, it better not, or it's a dead book. But but even that, like, it's almost Schrodinger's cat for me, this idea of exploring, a narrator exploring all characters with equal respect, where, you know, to have Lillian and Kaddish become so, they end up with two completely separate realities, and that's what I wanted to look at is, you know, respectfully how differing realities can survive together or not under one roof.
And when you discuss sort of the quantum mechanics novel, this is going to lead me to Pynchon and The Nose Job.
Yes.
In the ministry, Kaddish is given as payment a nose job for him and Lillian, which is probably in American literature. There's Esther's nose job in Thomas Pynchon's V, and now your description Talk a little. Obviously, there's the Gogol.
I was going to say
reference.
That,
yeah, yes, that's there. But also, there's the notion of erasing your past, changing your face, and all that, which is sort of you set up there. So talk a little bit about. But just keep in mind that we're in LA when you're talking about plastic surgery.
Yeah, well, this is it. I got, you know what? It's funny because I think people are responding different. Like it's fed in as it feeds into the book was as an issue of identity. But that's it. It's the idea of calling it cosmetic surgery and be like, I'm going to get my legs waxed and a nose job. They're very different.
Whiten your teeth.
Things, exactly. But so I guess just, yeah, this is the whole book is about identity for me. And I got very interested in this idea. Argentina is like the capital of plastic surgery of the planet. And I just thought of this idea of what it is to the continuum for, you know, if a mother has a nose job and a father has a nose job and they have a baby, they're not born with the post-op nose, you know, but that's my feeling, you know. But I just got interested in this idea of what it is in terms of a genetic link. You know, in the end, it's they no longer look like their son who's gone missing and the mother has lost her son's face. You know, that it goes to the past. Everything in this book, I guess we need to talk about the nature of evil, you know, in what this government, what I'm looking at, how it fits in the book, is that, you know, if I kill someone right now, that person is dead in the moment and they no longer have a future. But the idea of disappearing is just, to me, like this true form of evil because it reaches into the past. It undoes. People were undone. It was as if they never were. And, you know, I look at that through names.
Why cut off our noses, Mrs. Posnan, only to spite our faces is what one of your characters said.
Yeah. Well, that was, again, I was just looking at, you know, through that as linked to the future and the past, what it is to alter the face. It's actually, I was reading Borges, who was quoting Pliny, who said, you know, to change a face, it is murder. And I thought about that idea of altering reality in that way.
But what's also, I mean, in this novel, there's so many echoes of the past. There are lines in this book where Lillian says, we are Jews, Kaddish. You can choose not to be one yourself, but you are to the government and to the people who have our son. I mean, that could be Berlin in 1936. It could be Budapest in 1944.
Well, this was a pure form. I think the Argentines are very confident. I think it was almost could have succeeded. I feel like there's always this historical failure to a certain kind of leader, which is they end up trying to take over the world. But I think Argentina might have stopped at its own borders. But it was absolutely a pure form of totalitarianism. It was extreme in that way. They were, you know, having a war with their... Actually, some people don't want to call it the Dirty War and have picked the absolute, you know, worst name that's so complicated to change it to. But, you know, I think it's fair to call it a dirty war. But they were having a war against their own people in this, you know,
whose rules were never clear to...
No, it was a fully... as a paranoid, that's, I think, why I'm drawn to these things. But, you know, it was very paranoid. This idea that if I was disappeared as a subversive, like anyone in this room could disappear because, you know, you have my name in your date book. You know, they would right. That doesn't work that way. It would be the reversal. But the point is they would go through people's date books like that and just take people on their list and then drive you around and have you pick other people. And it was enough to be, you could be, you know, captain of the high school volleyball team and seen as an organizer. It was very paranoid. They hated, they killed many psychologists and psychiatrists because they thought if you're not giving confession, you must be a commie if you're confessing to, you know.
And Buenos Aires has the most psychiatrists.
Yes, it does.
But so many things have resonance. I mean, there's a book burning scene, although this time it's done by Jews to try and protect themselves.
Yeah.
There's the supposedly righteous Gentile priest.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways this is a Holocaust novel, but that doesn't seem that taking place in a different time and place.
Yeah, I don't even know what to do with that. Like, in a sense, I mean, those are...
I mean, were those resonances there for you or not at all?
Those resonances are there when I order breakfast. Like, I'm, you know, all Holocaust all the time. You know, like, it's a very... But I think it was that idea of being raised. I mean, that's... I don't know if I said this already. I'm having deja vu.
Because I'm usually accused of that. So
yeah. No, but 1976 is the first year I remember. I remember the new quarters. I remember, you know, the bicentennial. And it was that idea that if you're raised with this memory, we will never forget. I mean, maybe people do that Darfur thing at their Seder or whatever, but I will never sit through another genocide. We won't let it happen. We have learned the lessons of history. And that idea to find out, like, the earliest time I remember already in my hemisphere, in my lifetime, you know, with their, you know, with, you know, Kissinger going back and forth. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that that was, you know, and that I never heard about it. This idea, we'll never forget that. I didn't hear about this till I was an adult. And I always say with this book, when people come up to me about it, the things that you think I made up are true and the things that are true. The idea of keeping fiction contained is that it doesn't often it has to have its own reality. But that idea, when they have them, they would take these kids up, torture them. There's a Sting song, there's a Joshua Tree, a U2 song. But anyway, but they would, you know, secret prisons, torture tables, take them up drugged and naked and drop them alive from, you know, C-140s into the sea. You know, it's just shocking to me, you know, that endless people come up to me and say, that's, you know, a crazy thing that you made up. I was like, that's the true thing in the book.
Right, right. And in this book, there's a lot of guilt and responsibility and irony all playing together at the same time. Yeah. I mean, the scene in particular where the son disappears is filled with that. And as a reader, I was kind of a little bit disturbed by some of Kaddish's sort of survivor's guilt. I mean, he says it was almost, you know, like a victim who blames himself.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I guess that's what I'm looking. Part of all these I actually got yelled at on Bookworm today for talking about this book as if it was talking about Argentina. He's like, this is a book of fathers and sons, you know, but in that thing, it's about identity. It's a primal relationship. And I think part of picking this very ugly, one of the nicest things that happened on the road was a father coming up and saying, this is my son's relationship, really happy about it. You know, like this is me and my son. And, you know, and it was that idea, like it's a sort of an, I don't know, I think for a lot of people, like a very hard time that growing up a father and a son. And that's another identity break and a time break that I was looking at, which is he's 19. And there's the moment where a son recognizes both, to a son's horror, you know, I'm not my father, but I am my father's son. And that's, you know, that needs to be looked at. But I think there is a survivor. I mean, because
after the son is, I mean, the extent to which they blame themselves.
Well, I'm filled with shame. And there's a filmmaker, maybe he doesn't mind, but Todd Solondz, I was talking about, I said, how do you make your movies? I feel like we're the same thing. We're both so filled with shame. How do you make your films? I couldn't make them. And he goes, you're guilty too. that's the difference. Uh-huh. I have shame and guilt. Uh-huh. He's just filled with shame.
Okay, I'm getting to two more questions, and then we'll go.
A Geneva Convention further.
Be free. There's one at the end. There's a girl in the prison scene.
Yeah.
Which seems very dissonant. Do you want to?
We can end on that's perfect. Yeah, we're talking about we were singing Aleph Bet Yehoshua's praises backstage, A Woman in Jerusalem, which is this amazing book.
Yes.
But he has all this sort of Greek chorus, and then he pushes it to the extreme, where there's this one moment where it's dreams are speaking that he brings in as a voice, as opposed to factory workers. And I said, did you know you were pushing? There's a moment where you just have to, you know, not be afraid, but there's things that you have to do for a book that you just have to believe in. But that was, for me, I felt like a moment that this book demanded, that's just an extreme break that I stand by. But
And then Kaddish finds a way to create for himself a fiction to go on.
That's up to the reader. But yes.
And so on that note, we're going to open up to questions. Now, there's going to be someone with a microphone. I have a request, which is that if you have a speech you'd like to make, or you want to talk about your family's cousin's brother, who knows, Nathan, please save that for afterwards if you want to fix him up, whatever, all that stuff. Otherwise, one question a person, at least in the beginning. Please, any questions? What? Do you have an apartment? Afterwards, also afterwards. Questions, please?
Real estate first.
Yes, in the back there, yeah.
What has been the reaction in Argentina or...
That is an excellent question. Of the many things that keep me up at night these days, we'll see. You know, at any time I get a question in the audience and I hear that accent, I get immediately frightened. You know, this old man in Philly, I was like, this is who I'm afraid of. But the folks who show up to readings have been great thus far, but I am afraid of the country. I wrote my heart out. It means the world to personally, this story to me. I feel like we're bequeathed our historical memory. I feel like, you know, I feel deeply connected to what happened there now, but I'm, you know, they call us Yankees, but they pronounce it Junkies, which sounds even better. But they will, you know, I'm not sure if they'll burn it. If they burn it, it should be at least extreme. I hope they burn it in the streets. I don't want them a little angry. Either welcome or burn it in the streets.
More publicity.
Yeah, better.
Anyone else, please? Right here. One second.
Do I have knowledge of any other language? Yeah, that's quicker. I can repeat them. I notice this is my language test now, is the more you learn a language, that's when you stop calling yourself fluent. So for a while, I was fluent in Hebrew until I recognized what there is to know. So yeah, my Hebrew is pretty strong, and I have no Spanish, which freaks out Argentines in Buenos Aires, because I can name the songs on the radio and have this weird, I'll be like, you know how much topsoil there is in Mendoza? You know, I have all these strange facts, but can't order my steak. Do we have time for one more?
We have one more. Any? Yeah, here in the second row.
Oh, you can scream unless you're happy. We're recording. Okay, sorry.
Writing as a modern secular Jew, why were you still captivated by the notion of eternity and being written out of it? You've got a character who's erasing headstones, even surviving the trauma of your religious upbringing. What held your imagination with losing eternity?
That is an excellent question. Yeah, I guess that's back to recognizing where I am and where the book is. Like, I just, in the rest of my life, I'm embarrassed of how superstitious I am, or how, you know, like, I call myself a lapsed atheist now. I'm so bad at being an atheist. It's terrible. But with fiction, I don't fight it. Like, that's, I have to have the rules to my world. And if those things matter in my head, you know, depending on the story, I have stories where God isn't in them and that doesn't matter. But in this one, yes, it's all about, you know, the time, it's all about infinity in that way. But I don't know why. But yes, it's just my head fire. The synapse is just fire. It's hard to undo them. Thanks.
There's someone over here. Yes.
You mentioned being traumatized by the experience of your first book's publication. I was just curious about that.
Yeah, well, we'll see if it actually ends up being less traumatic than this one. But it's just overwhelming. You know, that was joyous. I mean, there's all these, like, evil eye, stink eye things people want to do. You know, they'll be like, you know, for 10 years, people will be like, don't a lot of people commit suicide before they finish that second novel? People are endlessly, but they want it, you know, but they all say, like, isn't it really hard to follow up a success? You know, not as hard as a colossal failure, probably. But my point is, I'm so thankful for everything that happened. Hugely thankful. It was beyond my wildest dreams what happened last time. But I just, it's still an alarmingly strange, yeah, I've been calling this sort of like getting brainwashed in nice hotels these days, where like you get a few hours sleep and only cheeseburgers and get moved from city to city. It's a very unnerving and wonderful.
The phone rings and it's good things.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. But it was just an extremely strange process becoming public, until the nice thing now in the world is then you become on, you know, now I'm starting again, so.
A friend of mine just told me that there was a panel of writers, and they asked them what's their dream review, the opening line of their dream review, and one of them said that their dream review was, who was the schmuck editor who paid him $2 million for this novel?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, yes, sir?
Yeah.
Down here.
Should we make that the last one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Having written this novel, it seems like in an organic fashion. Did you know as you went along what the big themes were becoming, or have you been learning what it's about now that you're done?
Excellent question to end on. Yeah, I again, so removed myself from the process. I'm aware. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I so get through this by not caring what I think. You know, when people ask me, how do I write? I want to be a writer. I said, when the voice in your head says, you know, stick with it, listen to that one and ignore the other one. But in a sense, throughout the whole process, it does not matter what I think this book is about. It's absolutely none of my business. So yeah, I know those are things that keep me going, but it better be, I mean, that's the idea of my deep belief in building a complete universe. It better have all those things in it. And in that same way, where even back to Habeas Corpus, where I wasn't writing a political novel and the world changed around me and it became a political novel. I mean, that's a very strange, and that's the way hopefully books live and have their own lives. So yeah, not aware. Anyway,
and on that note,
thank you very much.
Thank
you for coming.
Nathan's going to be...
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.